I went looking for Vera. I found her in the back garden. She'd yanked her straw sun hat on so hard the brim touched her ears. And she was taking such snaps with those garden shears of hers that you'd have thought she was Madame Defarge chopping off heads instead of Vera Donovan cutting roses for the parlor and dining room. I walked right up to her and said, "That was a boogery thing you done, firing that girl like that." She stood up and gave me her haughtiest lady of the manor look. "Do you think so? I'm so glad to have your opinion, Dolores. I crave it, you know. Each night when I go to bed, I lie there in the dark, reviewing the day and asking the same question as each event passes before my eyes. What would Dolores St. George have done?" Well, that made me madder than ever. "I'll tell you one thing Dolores Claiborne don't do," I says, "and that's take it out on someone else when she's pissed off and disappointed about something. I guess I ain't enough of a high-riding bitch to do that." Her mouth dropped open like somebody'd pulled the bolts that held her jaw shut. I'm pretty sure that was the first time I really surprised her, and I marched away in a hurry before she could see how scared I was. My legs were shaking so bad by the time I got into the kitchen that I had to sit down, and I thought, "You're crazy, Dolores, tweaking her tail like that." I stood up enough to peek out the window over the sink, but her back was to me, and she was working her shears again for all she was worth. Roses were falling into her basket like dead soldiers with bloody heads. I was getting ready to go home that afternoon when she came up behind me and told me to wait a minute. She wanted to talk to me. I felt my heart sink all the way into my shoes. I had no doubt at all that my time had come. She'd tell me my services wouldn't be required anymore, give me one last kiss my back cheek stare, and then down the road I'd go, this time for good. You'd think it had been a relief to get shut of her, and I suppose in some ways it would have been. But I felt a pain around my heart just the same. I was 36, I'd been working hard since I was 16, and hadn't never been fired from a job. Just the same, there's some kinds of buggery bullshit a person has to stand up to. And I was trying with all my might to get ready to do that when I turned around to look at her. When I saw her face, though, I knew it wasn't firing she'd come to do. All the makeup she'd had on that morning was scrubbed off, and the way her eyelids were swole up gave me the idea she'd either been taking a nap or crying in her room. She had a brown paper grocery sack in her arms, and she kind of shoved it at me. "Here," she says. "What's this?" I asked her. "Two eclipse viewers and two reflector boxes," she says. "I thought you and Joe might like them. I happened to have..." She stopped then and coughed into her curled up fist before looking me square in the eye again. One thing I admired about her, Andy, no matter what she was saying or how hard it was for her, she'd look at you when she said it. "I happened to have two extras of each," she said. "Oh," I says, "I'm sorry to hear that." She waved it away like it was a fly, then asked me if I'd changed my mind about going on the ferry with her and her company. "No," I says, "I guess I'll put up my dogs on my own porch rail and watch it with Joe from there. Or if he's acting out the tartar, I'll go down to East Head." "Speaking of acting out the tartar," she says, still looking right at me, "I want to apologize for this morning and ask if you'd call Mabel Jolander and tell her I've changed my mind." It took a lot of guts for her to say that, Andy. You didn't know her the way I did, so I guess you'll just have to take my word for it. But it took an awful lot of guts. When it came to apologizing, Vera Donovan was pretty much of a teetotaler. "Sure I will," I said, speaking kind of gentle. I almost reached out and touched her hand, but in the end I didn't. "Only it's Karen, not Mabel. Mabel worked here 6 or 7 years ago. She's in New Hampshire these days, her mother says, working for the telephone company and doing real well. Karen, then, she says, ask her back. Just say I've changed my mind, Dolores. Not one word more than that. Do you understand? Yes, I says. And thanks for the eclipse things. They'll come in handy, I'm sure. You're very welcome, she says. I open the door to go out, and she says, Dolores? I look back over my shoulder, and she give me a funny little nod, as if she knew things she had no business knowing. Sometimes you have to be a high-riding bitch to survive, she says. Sometimes being a bitch is all a woman has to hold on to. And then she closed the door in my face, but gentle. She didn't slam it. All right, here comes the day of the eclipse, and if I'm going to tell you what happened, everything that happened, I ain't going to do it dry. I've been talking for damn near 2 hours straight by my watch, long enough to burn the oil off of anyone's bearings, and I'm still a long way from being done. So I tell you what, Andy, either you part with an inch of the Jim Beam you got in your desk drawer, or we hang it up for tonight. What do you say? There! Thank you. Boy, don't that just hit the spot? No, put it away. One's enough to prime the pump. Two might not do anything but clog the pipes. All right, here we go again. On the night of the 19th, I went to bed so worried I was almost sick to my stomach with it, because the radio said there was a good chance it was going to rain. I'd been so goddamn busy planning what I was going to do and working up my nerve to do it that the thought of rain had never even crossed my mind. I'm going to toss and turn all night, I thought as I laid down. And then I thought, no, you ain't, Dolores. And I'll tell you why. You can't do a damn thing about the weather, and it don't matter anyway. You know you mean to do for him, even if it rains like a bastard all day long. You've gone too far to back out now. And I did know that, so I closed my eyes and went out like a light. Saturday, the 20th of July, 1963, come up hot and muggy and cloudy. The radio said there most likely wouldn't be any rain after all, unless it was just a few thunder showers late in the evening. But the clouds were going to hang around most of the day, and chances of the coastal communities actually seeing the eclipse were no better than 50-50. It felt like a big weight had slipped off my shoulders just the same, and when I went off to Vera's to help serve the big brunch buffet she had planned, my mind was calm and my worries behind me. It didn't matter that it was cloudy, you see. It wouldn't even matter if it showered off and on, as long as it didn't pour. The hotel people would be up on the roof, and Vera's people would be out on the reach, all of them hoping there'd be just enough of a break in the cloud cover to let them get a look at what wasn't going to happen again in their lifetimes. Not in Maine, anyhow. Hope's a powerful force in human nature, you know. No one knows that better than me. As I remember, Vera ended up having 18 house guests that Friday night, but there were even more at the Saturday morning buffet, 30 or 40, I'd say. The rest of the people who'd be going with her on the boat, and they were island folk for the most part, not from away, would start gathering at the town dock around 1 o'clock, and the old princess was due to set out around 2. By the time the eclipse actually began, 4:30 or so, the first 2 or 3 kegs of beer probably be empty. I expected to find Vera all nerved up and ready to fly out of her own skin, but I sometimes think she made a damn career out of surprising me. She was wearing a billowy red and white thing that looked more like a cape than a dress, a caftan, I think they're called, and she'd pulled her hair back in a simple horsetail that was a long way from the 50-buck hairdos she usually sported in those days. She went around and around the long buffet table that was set up on the back lawn near the rose garden, visiting and laughing with all her friends, most of them from Baltimore, judging by the look and sound. But she was different that day than she had been during the week leading up to the eclipse. Remember me telling you how she went zooming back and forth like a jet plane? On the day of the eclipse, she was more like a butterfly, visiting among the plants. And her laugh wasn't so shrill or loud. She seen me bringing out a tray of scrambled eggs and hurried over to give me some instructions, but she didn't walk like she had been walking the last few days, like she really wanted to be running. And the smile stayed on her face. I thought, she's happy. That's all it is. She's accepted that her kids aren't coming and has decided she can be happy just the same. And that was all, unless you knew her and knew how rare a thing it was for Vera Donovan to be happy. Tell you something, Andy. I knew her another 30 years almost, but I don't think I ever saw her really happy again. Content, yes, and resigned, but happy, radiant and happy, like a butterfly wandering in a field of flowers on a hot summer afternoon? I don't think so. Dolores, she says, Dolores Claiborne. It never occurred to me until a lot later that she'd called me by my maiden name, even though Joe was still alive and well that morning, and she never had before. When it did occur to me, I shivered all over, the way you're supposed to do when a goose walks across the place where you'll be buried someday. Morning, Vera, I said back. I'm sorry the day's so gray. She glanced up at the sky, which was hung with low, humid summer clouds, then smiled. The sun will be out by 3 o'clock, she says. You make it sound like you put in a work order for it, I says. I was only teasing, of course, but she gave me a serious little nod and said, yes, that's just what I did. Now run into the kitchen, Dolores, and see why that stupid caterer hasn't brought out a fresh pot of coffee yet. I set out to do as she asked, but before I got more than 4 steps toward the kitchen door, she called after me just like she'd done 2 days before, when she told me that sometimes a woman has to be a bitch to survive. I turned around with the idea in my head that she was going to tell me the same thing all over again. She didn't, though. She was standing there in her pretty red and white tent dress, with her hands on her hips and that horsetail lying over one shoulder, looking not a year over 21 in that white morning light. Sunshine by 3, Dolores, she says. See if I'm not right. The buffet was over by 11, and me and the girls had the kitchen to ourselves by noon, the caterer and his people having moved on down to the Island Princess to start getting ready for Act 2. Vera herself left fairly late, around 12:15. Driving the last 3 or 4 of her company down to the dock herself in the old Ford ranch wagon she kept on the island. I stuck with the washing up until 1 o'clock or so, then told Gail Levesque, who was more or less my second in command that day, that I felt a little headachy and sick to my stomach, and I was going to go on home now that the worst of the mess was ridded up. On my way out, Karen Jolander gave me a hug and thanked me. She was crying again, too. I swan to goodness that girl never stopped leaking around the eyes all the years I knew her. I don't know who's been talking to you, Karen, I said, but you don't have nothing to thank me for. I didn't do a single solitary thing. No one said a word to me, she says, but I know it was you, Mrs. St. George. No one else would dare speak up to the old dragon. I gave her a kiss on the cheek and told her I thought she wouldn't have nothing to worry about as long as she didn't drop any more plates. Then I set out for home. I remember everything that happened, Andy. Everything. But from the time I stepped off Vera's driveway and onto Center Drive, it's like remembering things that have happened in the brightest, most real-seeming dream you've ever had in your life. I kept thinking, I'm going home to kill my husband. I'm going home to kill my husband. Like I could pound it into my head the way you'd pound a nail into some thick wood like teak or mahogany. if only I kept at it long enough. But looking back on it, I guess it was in my head all the time. It was my heart that couldn't understand. Although it was only 1:15 or so when I got to the village, and the start of the eclipse still over 3 hours away, the streets were so empty it was spooky. It made me think of that little town down in the southern part of the state where they say no one lives. Then I looked up at the roof of the harbor side, and that was spookier still. There must have been 100 people or more up there already, strolling around and checking the sky like farmers at planting time. I looked downhill to the dock and seen the princess there, her gangplank down and the auto deck full of people instead of cars. They was walking around with drinks in their hands, having themselves a big open-air cocktail party. The dock itself was crammed with people, and there must have been 500 small boats, more'n I'd ever seen out there at one time anyway, on the reach already, anchored and waiting. And it seemed like everyone you saw, whether they was on the hotel roof or the town dock or the princess, was wearing dark glasses and holding either a smoked glass eclipse viewer or a reflector box. There's never been a day like it on the island before or since, and even if I hadn't had in mind what I did have in mind, I think it would have felt like a dream to me. The green front was open, eclipse or no eclipse. I expect that booger'll be doing business as usual even on apocalypse morn. I stopped in, bought a bottle of Johnny Walker Red, then walked on out East Lane to the house. I gave the bottle to Joe first thing, didn't make any bones about it, just plopped it into his lap. Then I walked into the house and got the bag Vera had given me, the one with the eclipse viewers and the reflector boxes in it. When I came out on the back porch again, he was holding that bottle of scotch up so he could see the color. "Are you going to drink it or just admire it?" I asked him. He gave me a look, kind of suspicious, and says, "Just what the hell is this, Dolores?" "It's a present to celebrate the eclipse," I said. "If you don't want it, I can always pour it down the sink." I made as if to reach for it, and he yanked it back real quick. "You've been giving me one hell of a lot of presents just lately," he says. "We can't afford stuff like this, eclipse or no eclipse." That didn't stop him from getting out his pocket knife and slitting the seal, though. Didn't even seem to slow him down. "Well, to tell you the truth, it's not just the eclipse," I says. "I just been feeling so good and so relieved that I wanted to share some of my happiness. And since I've noticed that most of what seems to make you happy comes out of a bottle." I watched him take the cap off and pour himself a knock. His hand was shaking a little bit, and I wasn't sorry to see it. The raggeder he was, the better my chances would be. "What have you got to feel good about?" he asks. "Did somebody invent a pill to cure ugly?" "That's a pretty mean thing to say to someone who just bought you a bottle of premium scotch," I said. "Maybe I really should take it back." I reached for it again, and he pulled it back again. "Fat chance," he says. "Then be nice," I told him. "What happened to all that gratitude you were supposed to be learning in your AA? He never minded that, just went on looking at me like a store clerk, trying to decide if someone had passed him a phony tin. "What's got you feeling so goddamn good?" he asks again. "It's the brats, isn't it? Having them out of the house." "Nope, I miss him already," I said, and it was the truth, too. "Yeah, you would," he says, and drinks his drink. "So what is it?" "I'll tell you later," I says, and start getting up. He grabbed my arm and said, "Tell me now, Dolores. You know I don't like it when you're fresh." I looked down at him and says, "You better take your hand off me, or that expensive bottle of hooch might end up getting broke over your head. I don't want to fight with you, Joe, especially not today. I've got some nice salami, some Swiss cheese, and some water biscuits." "Water biscuits," he says. "Jesus wept, woman." "Never mind," I says. "I'm going to make us a tray of hors d'oeuvres. Every bit as nice as the ones Vera's guests are going to have out on that ferry." Fancy food like that gives me the shits, he says. Never mind any horse's ovaries. Just make me a sandwich.
All right, I agreed. I will. He was looking toward the reach by then. Probably me mentioning the ferry had put him in mind of it, with his lower lip pooching out in that ugly way it had. There were more boats out there than ever, and it looked to me like the sky over him had lightened up a little bit.
Look at him, he says, in that sneering way of his. The one his youngest son was trying so goddamn hard to copy. Ain't nothing gonna happen that's any more'n a thunderhead going across the sun. And they're all just about shooting off in their pants. I hope it rains. I hope it comes down so hard it drowns that snooty cunt you work for, and the rest of them too.
That's my Joe, I says. Always cheery, always charitable.
He looked around at me, still holding that bottle of scotch curled against his chest, like a bear with a chunk of honeycomb. What in the name of Christ are you running on about, woman?
Nothing, I says. I'm going inside to fix the food. A sandwich for you and some hors d'oeuvres for me. Then we'll sit and have a couple of drinks and watch the eclipse. Vera sent down a viewer and a reflector box thingamajig for each of us. And when it's over, I'll tell you what's got me feeling so happy. It's a surprise.
I don't like fucking surprises, he says.
I know you don't, I told him. But you'll get a kick out of this one, Joe. You'd never guess it in 1,000 years. Then I went into the kitchen so he could really get started on that bottle I'd bought him at the Greenfront. I wanted him to enjoy it. I really did. After all, it was the last liquor he was ever going to drink. He wouldn't need AA to keep him off the sauce either, not where he was going. That was the longest afternoon of my life, and the strangest, too. There he was, sitting on the porch in his rocker, holding the paper in one hand and a drink in the other, bitching in the open kitchen window at me about something the Democrats were trying to do down in Augusta. He'd forgotten all about trying to find out what I was happy about, and all about the eclipse as well. I was in the kitchen making him a sandwich, humming a tune and thinking, make it good, Dolores. Put on some of that red onion he likes and just enough mustard to make it tangy. Make it good, 'cause it's the last thing he's ever gonna eat. From where I was standing, I could look out along the line of the woodshed and see the white rock and the edge of the blackberry tangle. The handkerchief I'd tied to the top of one of the bushes was still there. I could see that, too. It went nodding back and forth in the breeze. Every time it did, I thought of that spongy well cap right under it. I remember how the birds sang that afternoon, and how I could hear some of the people out on the reach yelling back and forth to each other, their voices all tiny and far. They sounded like voices on the radio. I can even remember what I was humming. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound. I went on humming it while I made my crackers and cheese. I didn't want them any more than a hen wants a flag, but I didn't want Joe wondering why I wasn't eating either. It must have been 2:15 or so when I went back out on the porch with the tray of food balanced in one hand like a waitress and the bag Vera'd give me in the other. The sky was still overcast, but you could see it really had gotten quite a bit lighter. That was a good little feed, as things turned out. Joe wasn't much for compliments, but I could see from the way he put down his paper and looked at his sandwich while he was eating that he liked it. I thought of something I'd read in some book or saw in some movie. The condemned man ate a hearty meal. Once I'd got that in my head, I couldn't get rid of the damn thing. It didn't stop me from digging into my own kip, though. Once I got started, I kept going until every one of those cheese and cracker things were gone, and I drank a whole bottle of Pepsi as well. Once or twice I found myself wondering if most executioners have good appetites on the days when they have to do their job. It's funny what a person's mind will get up to when that person's nerving herself up to do something, isn't it? The sun broke through the clouds just as we were finishing up. I thought of what Vera'd told me that morning, looked down at my watch and smiled. It was 3:00, right on the button. About that same time, Dave Pelletier, he delivered mail on the island back in those days, drove back toward town, hell-bent for election, and pulling a long rooster tail of dust behind him. I didn't see another car on East Lane until long after dark. I put the plates and my empty soda bottle on the tray, scooching down to do it, and before I could stand up, Joe done something he hadn't done in years, put one of his hands on the back of my neck and give me a kiss. I fared better. His breath was all booze and onion and salami, and he hadn't shaved. But it was a kiss just the same, and nothing mean or half-assed or peckish about it. It was just a nice kiss, and I couldn't remember the last time he'd given me one. I closed my eyes and let him do it. I remember that, closing my eyes and feeling his lips on mine and the sun on my forehead. One was as warm and nice as the other. "That weren't half bad, Dolores," he said, which was high praise coming from him. I had a second there when I kind of wavered. I ain't gonna sit here and say different. It was a second when it wasn't Joe putting his hands all over Selena that I saw, but the way his forehead looked in study hall back in 1945. How I saw that and wanted him to kiss me just the way he was kissing me now. How I thought, if he kissed me, I'd reach up and touch the skin there on his brow while he did it. See if it's as smooth as it looks. I reached out my hand and touched it then, just like I'd dreamed of doing all those years before, when I'd been nothing but a green girl. And the minute I did, that inside eye opened wider than ever. What it saw was how he'd go on if I let him go on, not just getting what he wanted from Selena, or spending the money he'd robbed out of his kids' bank accounts, but working on him, belittling Joe Jr. for his good grades and his love of history, clapping little Pete on the back whenever Pete called somebody a kike or said one of his classmates was lazy as a nigger. Working on him, always working on him. He'd go on until they were broke or spoiled if I let him. And in the end, he'd die and leave us with nothing but bills and a hole to bury him in. Well, I had a hole for him, one 30 feet deep instead of just 6, and lined with chunks of fieldstone instead of dirt. You bet I had a hole for him. And one kiss after 3 years, or maybe even 5, wasn't going to change it. Neither was touching his forehead, which had been a lot more the cause of all my trouble than his puling little dingus ever was. But I touched it again just the same, traced one finger over it, and thought about how he kissed me on the patio of the Samoset Inn while the band inside played Moonlight Cocktail, and how I'd been able to smell his father's cologne on his cheeks when he did. Then I hardened my heart. "I'm glad," I said, and picked up the tray again. "Why don't you see what you can make of those viewers and the reflector boxes while I do up these few dishes?" "I don't give a fuck about anything that rich cunt gave you," he says. "And I don't give a fuck about the goddamn eclipse either. I've seen dark before. It happens every goddamn night." "All right," I says. "Suit yourself." I got as far as the door, and he says, "Maybe you and me can get up to Dickens later on. What would you think about that, Dee?" "Maybe," I says, all the time thinking there was going to be plenty of Dickens, all right. Before it got dark for the second time that day, Joe St. George was going to get more Dickens than he'd ever dreamed of. I kept my good weather eye on him while I was standing at the sink and doing up our few dishes. He hadn't done anything in bed but sleep, snore, and fart for years, and I think he knew as well as I did that the booze had as much to do with that as my ugly face. Probably more. I was scared that maybe the idea of getting his ashes hauled later on would cause him to put the cap back on that bottle of Johnny Walker. But no such bad luck. For Joe, fucking, pardon my language, Nancy, was just a fancy, like kissing me had been. The bottle was a lot realer to him. The bottle was right there where he could touch it. He'd gotten one of the eclipse viewers out of the bag and was holding it up by the handle, turning it this way and that, squinting at the sun through it. He reminded me of a thing I saw on TV once, a chimpanzee trying to tune a radio. Then he put it down and poured himself another drink. When I came back out on the porch with my sewing basket, I saw he was already getting that owly red-around-the-eyes look he had when he was on his way from moderately tickled to thoroughly tanked. He looked at me pretty sharp, just the same, no doubt wondering if I was going to bitch at him. "Don't mind me," I says, sweet as sugar pie. "I'm just going to sit here and do a little mending and wait for the eclipse to start. It's nice that the sun came out, isn't it?"
"Christ, Dolores, you must think this is my birthday," he says.
His voice had started to get thick and furry. "Well, something like it, maybe," I says, and began sewing up a rip in a pair of little Pete's jeans. The next hour and a half passed slower than any time had since I was a little girl, and my Aunt Cloris promised to come and take me to my first movie down in Ellsworth. I finished little Pete's jeans, sewed patches on two pairs of Joe Jr.'s chinos. Even back then, that boy would absolutely not wear jeans. I think part of him had already decided he was going to be a politician when he grew up. And hemmed two of Selena's skirts. The last thing I did was sew a new fly in one of Joe's two or three pairs of good slacks. They were old, but not entirely worn out. I remember thinking they would do to bury him in. Then, just when I thought it was never going to happen, I noticed the light on my hands seemed a little dimmer.
"Dolores," Joe says, "I think this is what you and all the rest of the fools have been waiting for."
"Yeah," I says, "I guess." The light in the dooryard had gone from that strong afternoon yellow it has in July to a kind of faded rose, and the shadow of the house laying across the driveway had taken on a funny, thin kind of look I'd never seen before and never have since. I took one of the reflector boxes from the bag, held it out the way Vera'd showed me about 100 times in the last week or so, and when I did, I had the funniest thought. "That little girl is doing this too," I thought. "The one who's sitting on her father's lap. She's doing this very same thing." I didn't know what that thought meant then, Andy, and I don't really know now. But I'm telling you anyway, because I made up my mind I'd tell you everything, and because I thought of her again later. Except in the next second or two, I wasn't just thinking of her. I was seeing her, the way you see people in dreams, or the way I guess the Old Testament prophets must have seen things in their visions. A little girl, maybe 10 years old, with her own reflector box in her hands, she wearing a short dress with red and yellow stripes, a kind of sundress with straps instead of sleeves, you know, and lipstick the color of peppermint candy. Her hair was blonde and put up in the back like she wanted to look older than she really was. I saw something else as well, something that made me think of Joe. Her daddy's hand was on her leg, way up high, higher than it ought to have been, maybe. Then it was gone.
"Dolores," Joe asked me, "you all right?"
"What do you mean?" I asks back. "'Course I am."
"You looked funny there for a minute."
"It's just the eclipse," I says. And I really think that's what it was, Andy. But I also think that little girl I saw then and again later was a real little girl, and that she was sitting with her father somewhere else along the path of the eclipse at the same time I was sitting on the back porch with Joe. I looked down in the box and seen a little tiny white sun, so bright it was like looking at a 50-cent piece on fire, with a dark curve bit into one side of it. I looked at it for a little while, then at Joe. He was holding up one of the viewers, peering into it.
"God damn," he says. I didn't know if he'd changed his mind or if it was the booze talking and didn't care. "She's disappearing, all right."
The crickets started to sing in the grass right about then. I guess they'd decided sundown was coming early that day, and it was time for them to crank up. I looked out on the reach at all the boats and saw the water they were floating on looked a darker blue now. There was something about them that was creepy and wonderful at the same time. My brain kept trying to believe that all those boats sitting there under that funny dark summer sky were just a hallucination. I glanced at my watch and saw it was going on 10 till 5. Still over half an hour until the eclipse would be total, which meant that for the next hour or so, everyone on the island would be thinking about nothing else and watching nothing else. East Lane was dead empty. Our neighbors were either on the Island Princess or the hotel roof, and if I really meant to do him, the time had come. My guts felt like they were all wound into one big spring, and I couldn't quite get that thing I'd seen, the little girl sitting on her daddy's lap, out of my mind. But I couldn't let either of those things stop me or even distract me, not for a single minute. I knew if I didn't do it right then, I wouldn't ever. I put the reflector box down beside my sewing and said, "Joe."
"What?" he asked me.
He'd poo-pooed the eclipse before, but now that it had actually started, it seemed like he couldn't take his eyes off it. His head was tipped back, and the eclipse viewer he was looking through cast one of those funny faded shadows on his face.
"It's time for the surprise," I said.
"What surprise?" he asks. And when he lowered the eclipse viewer, which was just this double layer of special polarized glass in a frame, if I ain't already said so, to look at me, I saw it wasn't fascination with the eclipse after all, or not completely. He was halfway to being shit-faced, and so groggy I got a little scared. If he didn't understand what I was saying, my plan was buggered before it even got started. What was I going to do then? I didn't know. The only thing I did know scared the hell out of me. I wasn't going to turn back. No matter how wrong things went or what happened later, I wasn't going to turn back. Then he reached out a hand, grabbed me by the shoulder, and shook me. "What in God's name are you talking about, woman?" he says. "You know the money in the kids' bank accounts?" I asks him. His eyes narrowed a little, and I saw he wasn't anywhere near as drunk as I'd first thought. I understood something else, too. That one kiss didn't change a thing. Anyone can give a kiss, after all. A kiss was how Judas Iscariot showed the Romans which one was Jesus. "What about it?" he says.
"You took it.
Like hell."
"Oh, yes," I says.
"After I found out you'd been fooling with Selena, I went to the bank. I meant to withdraw the money, then take the kids and get them away from you." His mouth dropped open, and for a few seconds he just gaped at me. Then he started to laugh. Just leaned back in his rocker and laughed while the day went on getting darker all around him.
"Well, you got fooled, didn't you?" he says.
Then he helped himself to a little more scotch and looked up at the sky through the eclipse viewer again. This time I couldn't hardly see the shadow on his face.
"Half gone, Dolores," he says. "Half gone now, maybe a little more."
I looked down into my reflector box and seen he was right. Only half of that 50-cent piece was left, and more was going all the time. "Yeah," I says, "half gone, so it is. As to the money, Joe..."
"You just forget that," he told me. "Don't trouble your pointy little head about it. That money's just about fine."
"Oh, I'm not worried about it," I says, "not a bit. The way you fooled me, though, that weighs on my mind." He nodded, kind of solemn and thoughtful, as if to show me he understood and even sympathized. But he couldn't hold on to the expression. Pretty soon he busted out laughing again, like a little kid who's getting scolded by a teacher he ain't in the least afraid of. He laughed so hard he sprayed a little silver cloud of spit into the air in front of his mouth.
"I'm sorry, Dolores," he says when he was able to talk again. "I don't mean to laugh, but I did steal a march on you, didn't I?"
"Oh, yeah," I agreed. It wasn't nothing but the truth, after all. fooled you right and proper, he says, laughing and shaking his head the way you do when someone tells a real knee-slapper. Yeah, I agreed along with him. But you know what they say. Nope, he says. He dropped the eclipse viewer into his lap and turned to look at me. He'd laughed so hard there were tears standing in his piggy little bloodshot eyes. You're the one with a saying for every occasion, Dolores. What do they say about husbands who finally put one over on their meddling busybody wives? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me, I says. You fooled me about Selena, and then you fooled me about the money. But I guess I finally caught up to you. Well, maybe you did and maybe you didn't, he says. But if you're worried about it being spent, you can just stop. Because I broke in there. I ain't worried, I says. I told you that already. I ain't a bit worried. He give me a hard look then, Andy, his smile drying up little by little. You got that smart look on your face again, he says. The one I don't much care for. Tough titty, I says. He looked at me for a long time, trying to figure out what was going on inside my head. But I guess it was as much a mystery to him then as ever. He pooched his lip out again and sighed so hard he blew back the lock of hair that had fallen on his forehead. Most women don't understand the first thing about money, Dolores, he says, and you're no exception to the rule. I put it all together in one account, that's all. So it'd draw more interest. I didn't tell you because I didn't want to listen to a lot of your ignorant bullshit. Well, I've had to listen to some anyway, like I just about always do, but enough's enough. Then he raised up the eclipse viewer again to show me the subject was closed. One account in your own name, I says. So what? He asked. By then it was like we were sitting in a deep twilight, and the trees had begun fading against the horizon. I could hear a whippoorwill singing from behind the house and a nightjar from somewhere else. It felt like the temperature had begun to drop, too. It all gave me the strangest feeling, like living in a dream that somehow turned real. Why shouldn't it be in my name? I'm their father, ain't I? Well, your blood is in 'em. If that makes you a father, I guess you are one. I could see him trying to figure out if that one was worth picking up and yanking on for a while, and deciding it weren't. You don't want to talk about this any more, Dolores, he says. I'm warning you. Well, maybe just a little more, I says, back, smiling. You forgot all about the surprise, you see. He looked at me suspicious again. What the fuck are you babbling on about, Dolores? Well, I went to see the man in charge of the savings department at Coastal Northern in Johnsport, I says. A nice man named Mr. Pease. I explained what happened, and he was awful upset, especially when I told him the original savings books weren't missing, like you told him they were. That was when Joe lost what little interest in the eclipse he'd had. He just sat there in that shitty old rocker of his, staring at me with his eyes wide open. There was thunder on his brow, and his lips were pressed down into a thin white line like a scar. He dropped the eclipse viewer back into his lap, and his hands were opening and closing real slow. It turned out you weren't supposed to do that, I told him. Mr. Pease checked to see if the money was still in the bank. When he found out it was, we both heaved a big sigh of relief. He asked me if I wanted him to call the cops and tell him what happened. I could see from his face he was hoping like hell I'd say no. I asked if he could issue that money over to me. He looked it up in a book and said he could. So I said, that's what we'll do then. And he did it. So that's why I ain't worried about the kid's money anymore, Joe. I've got it now instead of you. Ain't that a corker of a surprise? You lie, Joe shouted at me and stood up so fast his rocker almost fell over. The eclipse viewer fell out of his lap and broke to pieces when it hit the porch floor. I wish I had a picture of the way he looked just then. I'd stuck it to him all right, and it went in all the way to the hilt. The expression on the dirty son of a whore's face was pert near worth everything I'd been through since that day on the ferry with Selina. "They can't do that," he yells. "You can't touch a cent of that dough. Can't even look at the fucking passbook." "Oh, no," I says. "Then how come I know you already spent 300 of it? I'm thankful it wasn't more, but it still makes me mad as hell every time I think of it. You're nothing but a thief, Joe St. George. One so low he'd even steal from his own children." His face was as white as a corpse's in the gloom. Only his eyes was alive, and they were burning with hate. His hands was held out in front of him, opening and closing, opening and closing. I glanced down for just a second and saw the sun, less than half by then, just a fat crescent, reflected over and over in the shattered pieces of smoked glass laying around his feet. Then I looked back at him again. It wouldn't do to take my eyes off him for long, not with the mood he was in. "What did you spend that 300 on, Joe? Whores? Poker? Some of both? I know it wa'n't another junker, because there ain't any new ones out back." He didn't say nothing, just stood there in front of me with his hands opening and closing, and behind him I could see the first lightning bugs stitching their lights across the dooryard. The boats out on the reach were just ghosts by then, and I thought of Vera. I figured if she wasn't in seventh heaven already, she was probably in the vestibule. Not that I had any business thinking about Vera. It was Joe I had to keep my mind on. I wanted to get him moving, and I judged one more good push should do it. "I guess I don't care what you spent it on anyway," I says. "I got the rest, and that's good enough for me. You can just go fuck yourself, if you can get your old limp noodle to stand up, that is." He stumbled across the porch, crunching the pieces of the eclipse viewer under his shoes, and grabbed me by the arms. I could have gotten away from him, but I didn't want to, not just then. "You want to watch your fresh mouth," he whispered, blowing scotch fumes down into my face. "If you don't, I'm apt to." Mr. Pease wanted me to put the money back in the bank, but I wouldn't. I figured if you were able to get it out of the kids' accounts, you might find a way to get it out of mine, too. Then he wanted to give me a check, but I was afraid that if you found out what I was up to before I wanted you to find out, you might stop payment on it. So I told Mr. Pease to give it to me in cash. He didn't like it, but in the end he did it, and now I have it, every cent. And I've put it in a place where it's safe. He grabbed me by the throat then. I was pretty sure he would, and I was scared, but I wanted it too. It'd make him believe the last thing I had to say that much more when I finally said it. But even that wa'n't the most important thing. Having him grab me by the throat like that made it seem more like self-defense somehow. That was the most important thing. And it was self-defense, no matter what the law might say about it. I know, because I was there, and the law wasn't. In the end, I was defending myself, and I was defending my children. He cut off my wind and throttled me back and forth, yelling. I don't remember all of it. I think he must have knocked my head against one of the porch posts once or twice. "I was a goddamn bitch," he said. "He'd kill me if I didn't give that money back. That money was his." Foolishness like that. I began to be afraid he really would kill me before I could tell him what he wanted to hear. The dooryard had gotten a lot darker, and it seemed full of those little stitching lights, as if the 100 or 200 fireflies I'd seen before had been joined by 10,000 or so more. And his voice sounded so far away that I thought it had all gone wrong somehow, that I'd fallen down the well instead of him. Finally, he let me go. I tried to stay on my feet, but my legs wouldn't hold me. I tried to fall back into the chair I'd been sitting in, but he'd yanked me too far away from it, and my ass just clipped the edge of the seat on my way down. I landed on the porch floor, next to the litter of broken glass that was all that was left of his eclipse viewer. There was one big piece left, with a crescent of sun shining in it like a jewel. I started to reach for it, then didn't. I wasn't going to cut him, even if he gave me the chance. I couldn't cut him. A cut like that, a glass cut, might not look right later. So you see how I was thinking. Not much doubt any place along the line about whether or not it was first degree, is there, Andy? Instead of the glass, I grabbed hold of my reflector box, which was made of some heavy wood. I could say I was thinking it would do to bash him with if it came to that, but it wouldn't be true. Right then, I really wasn't thinking much at all. I was coughing, though. Coughing so damned hard, it seemed a wonder to me that I wasn't spraying blood as well as spit. My throat felt like it was on fire. He pulled me back onto my feet so hard one of my slip straps broke, then caught the nape of my neck in the crook of his arm and yanked me toward him until we was close enough to kiss. Not that he was in a kissing mood anymore. "I told you what had happened if you didn't leave off being so fresh with me," he says. His eyes were all wet and funny, like he'd been crying. But what scared me about him was the way they seemed to be looking right through me, as if I wasn't really there for him anymore. "I told you a million times. Do you believe me now, Dolores?" "Yes," I said. He'd hurt my throat so bad I sounded like I was talking through a throat full of mud. "Yes, I do." "Say it again," he says. He still had my neck caught in the crook of his elbow, and now he squeezed so hard it pinched one of the nerves in there. I screamed. I couldn't help it. It hurt dreadful. That made him grin. "Say it like you mean it," he told me. "I do," I screamed. "I do mean it." I'd planned on acting frightened, but Joe saved me the trouble. I didn't have to do no acting that day, after all. "Good," he says. "I'm glad to hear it. Now tell me where the money is, and every red cent better be there." "It's out back of the woodshed," I says. I didn't sound like I was talking through a mouthful of mud anymore. By then I sounded like Groucho Marx on You Bet Your Life, which sort of fit the situation, if you see what I mean. Then I told him I put the money in a jar and hid the jar in the blackberry bushes. "Just like a woman," he sneers, and then give me a shove toward the porch steps. "Well, come on, let's go get it." I walked down the porch steps and along the side of the house with Joe right behind me. By then it was almost as dark as it gets at night, and when we reached the shed, I saw something so strange it made me forget everything else for a few seconds. I stopped and pointed up into the sky over the blackberry tangle. "Look, Joe," I says, "stars." And there were. I could see the Big Dipper at 5:15 on that summer's afternoon as clear as I ever saw it on a winter's night. It gave me goosebumps all over my body. But it wasn't nothing to Joe. He gave me a shove so hard I almost fell over. "Stars," he says. "You'll see plenty of them if you don't quit stalling, woman. I guarantee you that." I started walking again. Our shadows had completely disappeared, and the big white rock where me and Selena had sat that evening the year before stood out almost as bright as a spotlight, like I'd noticed it does when there's a full moon. The light wasn't like moonlight, Andy. I can't describe what it was like. How gloomy and weird it was. But it'll have to do. I know that the distances between things had gotten hard to judge, like they do in moonlight, and that you couldn't pick out any single blackberry bush anymore. They were all just one big smear with those fireflies dancing back and forth in front of them. Vera'd told me time and time again that it was dangerous to look straight at the eclipse. She said it could burn your retinas or even blind you. Still, I couldn't no more resist turning my head and taking one quick glance up over my shoulder than Lot's wife could resist taking one last glance back at the city of Sodom. What I saw has stayed in my memory ever since. Weeks, sometimes whole months, go by without me thinking about Joe, but hardly a day goes by when I don't think of what I saw that afternoon, when I looked up over my shoulder and into the sky. Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of salt because she couldn't keep her eyes front and her mind on her business, and I've sometimes thought it's a wonder I didn't have to pay the same price. The eclipse wasn't total yet, but it was close. The sky itself was a deep royal purple, and what I saw hanging in it above the reach looked like a big black pupil with a gauzy veil of fire spread out most of the way around it. On one side there was a thin crescent of sun still left, like beads of molten gold in a blast furnace. I had no business looking at such a sight, and I knew it. But once I had, it seemed like I couldn't look away. It was like, well, you might laugh, but I'm going to say it anyway. It was like that inside eye had gotten free of me somehow, that it had floated up into the sky and was looking down to see how I was going to make out. But it was so much bigger than I'd ever imagined, so much blacker. I probably would have looked at it until I went stone blind, except Joe gave me another shove and bashed me into the shed wall. That kind of woke me up, and I started walking again. There was a great big blue spot, the kind you see after someone takes a flash picture, hanging in front of me, and I thought, if you burned your retinas and have to look at that for the rest of your life, it'll serve you right, Dolores. It wouldn't be no more than the mark Cain had to bear. We walked past the white rock, Joe right behind me and holding on to the neck of my dress. I could feel my slip sliding down one side where the strap had broken. What with the dark and that big blue spot hanging in the middle of things, everything looked off kilter and out of place. The end of the shed wasn't nothing but a dark shape, like someone had taken a pair of shears and cut a roof-shaped hole in the sky. He pushed me toward the edge of the blackberry patch, and when the first thorn prinked my calf, I remembered that this time I'd forgot to put on my jeans. It made me wonder what else I might have forgot, but of course it was too late to change anything then. I could see that little scrap of cloth fluttering in the last of the light, and had just time to remember how the well cap lay beneath it. Then I tore out of his fist and pelted into the brambles, hell-bent for election.
"No, you don't, you bitch," he bawls at me,
and I could hear the bushes breaking as he trampled in after me. I felt his hand grab for the neck of my dress again and almost catch. I jerked loose and kept on going. It was hard to run because my slip was falling down and kept hooking on the brambles. In the end, they unraveled a great long strip of it and took plenty of meat off my legs as well. I was bloody from knees to ankles, but I never noticed till I got back in the house, and that was a long time after.
"Come back here,"
he bellowed, and this time I felt his hand on my arm. I yanked it free, and so he grabbed at my slip, which was floating out behind me like a bridal train by then. If it had held, he might have reeled me in like a big fish. But it was old and tired from being washed 200 or 300 times. I felt the strip he'd got hold of tear away and heard him curse, kind of high and out of breath. I could hear the sound of the brambles breaking and snapping and whipping in the air, but couldn't see hardly anything. Once we was in the blackberry tangle, it was darker than a woodchuck's asshole. And in the end, that hanky I tied up wasn't any help. I saw the edge of the well cap instead, no more than a glimmer of white in the darkness just ahead of me, and I jumped with all my might. I just cleared it, and because I was facing away from him, I didn't actually see him step onto it. There was a big crack sound, and then he hollered. No, that ain't right. He didn't holler, and I guess you know it as well as I do. He screamed, like a rabbit with its foot caught in a slip wire. I turned around and seen a big hole in the middle of the cap. Joe's head was sticking out of it, and he was holding on to one of those smashed boards with all his might. His hands were bleeding, and there was a little thread of blood running down his chin from the corner of his mouth. His eyes were the size of doorknobs.
"Oh, Christ, Dolores," he says. "It's the old well. Help me out quick before I fall all the way in."
I just stood there, and after a few seconds his eyes changed. I seen the understanding of what it had all been about come into him. I was never so scared as I was then, standing there on the far side of the well cap, and staring at him with that black sun hanging in the sky to the west of us. I had forgot my jeans, and he hadn't fallen right in like he was supposed to. To me, it seemed like everything had started going wrong. "Oh," he said. "Oh, you bitch." Then he started to claw and wriggle his way up.